You're listening to Manx Radio, and I'm Judith Lay, welcoming you to the podcast of The Manx Sky at Night with Howard Parkin.
The Nation Station, Manx Radio.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
And it is my pleasure to welcome into the studio Howard Parkin for this month's edition of the Manx Sky at Night. Fastamai, Howard.
Great to be here again.
And most important thing, before we start looking at the stars, how is your replacement knee?
Working wonderfully. I'm totally bionic now, Judith. I can run up and down stairs. Well, I wish. But no, it's a lot better, and I'm quite pleased with the progress. And it's a bit of a slog, but I'm getting there, and the surgeon's happy with me, so thank you for asking.
You can't ask for more than that. You're doing your exercises, all is
well. Yes.
You are also a frustrated man because it's the time of the year, isn't it? No dark skies.
No dark. You know, I was only saying to someone the other night, I've not seen a star for about 3 weeks. It's just, although last night, I believe, was clear. I missed it last night. We were out, but last night was clear. But it's been, look at it at the moment. Can't see. There's the boat just about drifting out into the fog at the moment. But no, it's the wrong time of the year because, of course, we get Midsummer's Day on the 21st of June. And then we don't get beyond astronomical twilight, which is when the sun is less than 18 degrees below the horizon. Sorry, more than 18 degrees below the horizon until 4th of August. So we don't get truly dark skies at all. So it's the time to brush off your telescope and maybe give it a polish and think about what you're going to do in the winter months. And having said that, there's always something to look for in the night sky, as we'll talk about in just a moment.
Well, this is what interests me, because you've actually said that tonight you want to talk about using binoculars.
Yeah.
Now, is that something that makes the most of when we haven't got any proper dark
skies?
Yeah,
it does, because obviously the binoculars see more. I mean, the reason I mention using the binoculars is, frustratingly for the British Isles, for the Isle of Man and Europe, basically, this latitude, the Milky Way is at its best this time of the year. The Milky Way, which is that band, we're inside the Milky Way, we're looking out the Milky Way, and it stretches from horizon to horizon in July. And it really is magnificent to see. And you've seen these wonderful pictures of the dark sky sites with the Milky Way on the horizon, all the rest. They are beautiful pictures. But if you want to see it for yourself, obviously this is the best time of the year to see it, but it's not dark. So that's why I suggest using binoculars, because even if it's a light night, it's not totally dark. If you look to the south, it's going to be darker in the south. But what you can do is, using your binoculars, just literally use your binoculars scanning from east to west or west to east, you'll all of a sudden notice in your binoculars a lot more faint stars. And that's the Milky Way. So a way to identify the Milky Way in the summer months is to use binoculars, because you'll see it much. Now, obviously, in the winter months and the spring and the summer and autumn and all the rest, we will see the Milky Way better, but it won't be stretching from horizon to horizon unless you're up at 4 o'clock in the morning in April or something like that time. But lots of times people say they've never seen the Milky Way. I'm amazed how many times people say it to me, who come along to my talks, my lectures, they've never seen the Milky Way. I remember seeing it as a child. And this harps back to my subject of light pollution, because we've just got so much light around these days. People don't see the wonders of the sky we saw as children. And, well, it's just something I keep banging the drum about. And one day someone might throw me drum back at me and do something about it. But we'll wait and see.
Yeah, but every time, every season, every age has its challenges.
Oh, yes.
Because where I grew up back in the 1950s, there was a lot of smog and pollution, because you could burn anything on your fire.
Well, of course you could.
You know, and so there was smoke billowing out.
The smogs of London and all that sort of places.
Yeah.
It was horrible.
So that worked against stargazing, didn't it?
I mean, you've got to get out in the countryside.
The
biggest advantage, it doesn't matter where you live in the world, get out into the countryside or the desert if you live near a desert, and you're always going to get clear skies. And we're blessed in the Isle of Man, as I often say. I might complain about the fact that we don't do enough about it, but We are blessed with very good skies in the Isle of Man, and as soon as we get to autumn, we'll all be out there with our telescopes looking at the different features and wondering at what we can look at next.
And sadly, the way the year is hurtling by, we'll be...
Oh, remind me.
It's scary.
It is really scary. It's very, very scary.
Anyway, and the other depressing thing is that there's no planets around.
Yeah, after the beginning of the year, when we had this alleged planetary parade, which was a load of rubbish, but all the planets were in the evening sky, they've all gone. That said, if you get up early in the morning, I know there's quite a few early risers listening to Manx Radio. If you get up early in the morning, Venus is dominating our morning sky before sunrise, as is Jupiter. You've got Jupiter and Venus very, very bright in our skies. You've also got Saturn up there. You've also got Mars just about visible low on the western horizon. That will go around the back of the sun and eventually be in the morning sky as well. So we've gone from a feast of all the planets in the evening to none, and pretty well they're all going to be in the morning sky. So although we always talk about astronomy as a point of view from doing it from about 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night, depending on the time of year, if you are out and about and you see something in the morning, you're going to the airport and you see this very, very bright object in the sky, this is Venus, which, of course, this time last year was in the evening sky and everyone thought it was the forthcoming star of Bethlehem and everything else. But Venus, of course, swaps round. It orbits the sun in 280 days, wherever it is. Therefore, it swaps sides from morning sky to evening sky, morning sky to evening sky. You know, the ancient astronomers used to think there were two planets. They used to call one of them Phosphorus and the other one was Venus. And the same thing happens with Mercury. We have forgotten the name of the other one, Mercury. Now, Mercury and Phosphorus and I can't remember the name of the fourth one, but they used to think there were four planets inside the orbit of the Earth and the Sun, but then they realised that basically they weren't. It was Apollo and Mercury and Phosphorus and Venus, that's it.
But you can understand that because they had nothing else to base on. They were just working out what they could see.
The only thing where they suddenly realised was, don't they, I say suddenly, it dawned on them eventually, you never saw it in the evening and the next morning, or in the morning and the next evening. So that made them realise eventually that they were inner planets and the solar system's geometry was starting to get understood. So it's fascinating. I always loved the ancient stuff. But Hesperus, Apollo and Phosphorus, there you go.
But it is good to put the whole picture together, as we're always saying, you know, because they were very, very clever. Before they got even the basic equipment, they just had
pens
to work
paper,
out what they could.
Everything was done by observational records. And one of my lectures I deliver is I always say, look at the observational evidence. Everything we do is down to observations, be it observing a television screen, be it observing a computer program or whatever. We interpret what we see with our brains. And in those days, the only thing they could see, there were no books, there was nothing else. All they could see was the sky. And they interpreted it. They came up with the idea that the Earth was flat. They came up with the idea that the stars went round the Earth and the Earth was in the middle and all this sort of stuff. But eventually, people, greater minds, worked out that they were wrong and they came up with other ideas. And it's just the same now. There's a big, big thing going on at the moment about the... It's called the Hubble tension. I mentioned this briefly last month.
We
believe that there's a problem. There's a major problem in measuring the expansion rate of the universe at the moment. They measure it different ways. And when they do so, they get different answers. And they shouldn't be getting different answers if the theory is correct. And although the Big Bang Theory, I might have mentioned this last month, although the Big Bang Theory is relatively safe, they still think the origin of the universe occurred at the moment of the Big Bang. What happened after and how galaxies and stars developed after that is a huge, big debate in the astrophysics community.
Isn't this fascinating? We did touch on this, Howard, but we didn't have enough
time. Very briefly,
We didn't, and we promised ourselves that we would go back to it and then kind of got overtaken by other things. But isn't it fascinating? We talk about Galileo and all the early people and say, well, you know, they did the best that they could, and then we came along and we trimmed up, or, you know, over the centuries, the theories were trimmed up. Wouldn't it be amazing if we've got something wrong and something is going to be revealed?
I think we have. I really think there's a major breakthrough. I don't know about a breakthrough, but what happens with any scientific theory, it gets put forward and it meets the test of time. It gets agreed and is tested and, you know, alternative theories are dismissed and all the rest. And the Big Bang Theory first came about in 1922, so it's over 100 years old now. And but this latest, this Hubble tension, it's called, because there's a tension in the community of the Hubble constant, which is a scientific term we use for to help understand the development of the universe. And I keep watching and looking on the internet to see if there's any more news about it. And somebody somewhere will publish a paper and suggest something, and then someone will say, well, that's not quite right. But from this, I'm guessing 4 or 5 years' time, there'll be another big theory that comes out which explains everything that we now see observationally with telescopes and everything else. But then something else will happen. And that's the way we are as a human mind. We develop over the centuries.
But do you think this has got the capacity to radically change something that we believe to be fact at the moment?
No, because I think the Big Bang theory tends to be safe. I think that the big thing is that the idea that the universe expanded from the moment of the Big Bang and has expanded outwards ever since. There is debate about whether the universe is still expanding, and the latest theory is it is. The James Webb confirmed that, and the Hubble has backed that up. But the problem they've got is the galaxies that they're seeing are too young and they're too well developed. And the idea was that as the universe evolved, the galaxies evolved at a certain time. But how can you have young, old galaxies in a young universe? So that's the problem. And I haven't seen anything that's come up with a logical suggestion as to how it's all happening. Maybe the universe is much, much bigger than we're thinking. That's one other theory. We think the universe is 13.8 billion years old. But there is a theory that maybe that's wrong, and maybe we need to look at the way we calculate that. But all good stuff.
Fascinating.
What's this space, literally?
Absolutely fascinating. Because there is a dreadful temptation that we think we know it all, we've got it all worked
out. Tick the box. Oh, we know that. Yeah, we know that.
And you were really expecting the James Webb to tell you things that you knew already.
That was the big kicker, I think. The idea was the James Webb would confirm everything and find more and explain more. But it's actually said, hang on a minute, you've got something wrong here. And there's three methods now. They're doing this thing, they're measuring this expansion of the universe. They're doing it with the Hubble, the James Webb, and there's also a team on the Earth doing it with some other fancy system.
Yeah.
And they're all coming up with different error bars, they call it. And no one has come up with a remotely decent answer yet, so I'm watching with much interest.
It must be drawing a lot of people to it, people who, you know, who are perhaps on the fringe of interest of these kind of things, but are really seeing it's going to be worth doing a deeper study.
I get it in my lectures, because one of the lectures I deliver is about the origin of the universe. I talk about the Big Bang and where we are and expansion. And it's messed up my lecture, because now I've got to throw so much at the end of it about what we don't know. I'm thinking I'm having to change the whole thing and just stick with facts, because we don't know the facts, and that's what the whole problem is.
No. So the Hubble is still working well?
Oh, still working well, and they're now reckoning they get that going till about 2030 at least. Without going into too much detail, they've got a series of gyroscopes on it to keep it steady. And what they're doing now, they've only got six in total. Three have failed. One is failing. So they've only got two left. So what they're doing now, they're operating with one gyroscope only. Basically, what they're doing is you're pointing your telescope at one point in space, and you ain't shifting it from that very much at all.
Yeah.
You're not going from one horizon to the next, or a slew across to the other horizon. No, they're doing all the observations in the same area and then very slowly moving it when they need to. And they think this is going to preserve it. They've got one left and one that's failing. There was talk about a rescue mission for it with SpaceX, but that's another story, because everything's gone a bit pear-shaped in space just at the moment, as we'll talk about later.
To be honest with you, I'm really looking, when I say looking forward, that's around. There seems to me that we've got a lot to cover in the space section.
We have indeed.
There's quite a bit of negativity about it at the moment,
I'm afraid there?
There
is, and understandably why when you think about it. But I just must mention before we finish that we did have a fantastic display last night, and indeed about a week ago, of noctilucent clouds.
Yeah.
These are the one feature we get in this time of the year we can see in a light sky. And I know Bill Bevan, and I know some of the other observers of the society, our chairman Mike, they reported on the internet, and Andy, I think, reported it, they'd see noctilucent clouds. These silvery, glowing clouds high up in the sky after sunset, well after sunset. So keep your eyes peeled for that, because they're always well looking out for.
Yeah. Right. OK, let's have a bit of music. I know that summer isn't a favourite time for stargazing, but this is another kind of summer night.
Crazy for me.
Met a boy, cute as can be.
It is a cracking song, isn't it? Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta and Summer Nights. Not the kind of summer nights that we're talking about, but it is back to this month's edition of The Manx Sky at Night. In the studio with me, it's Howard Parkin. Howard, space stories. There's not a lot of positivity at the moment,
no,
is there?
No, there's a lot of negativity around, I'm afraid, because budget cuts, financial issues and all sorts of stuff around the world, warfare, everything else, seems to be affecting the space community quite severely. And what has happened quite dramatically in the last few months is NASA have had their budgets across the board slashed dramatically. And these are for missions that are well underway at the moment. Some missions have been completely cancelled. Other things have been pulled and reduced in budget. Even the James Webb telescope, which is operating and everything else, even they've had their budget cut. And they've jumped up and down quite a lot, the scientists, and said, look, we need this to keep it going and everything else. And there's no threat to it currently. But there is serious worries that the money they're trying to find for other things, which I'm not criticising, sometimes you need to find money for other things. But having built up these programmes over the period of decades, just to pull the plug is just, it's unthinkable, really. And you see, I'm on my high horse again. I get off my soapbox now. The amount of times people say to me, oh, we shouldn't be going into space. We should be spending the money on Earth. Where do you think the money is going? The money is going on jobs. It's going on employment. It's going on social benefits. It's providing a huge industry that is basically, a lot of it's based in the United States, but it's around the world. And it isn't launching pound notes and into space. It's spending money. I mean, don't get me going on them defence budgets. We're all going to spend 5% of the gross national product on defence. I'm not saying it's not needed, but we only spend something like 0.5% on space. So, getting political, I'm afraid.
It's, well, inevitably, you have to, because it's a political situation that you're reporting on. You know, you can't be selective, can you, Howard?
No.
You're here to give us a whole picture
hopefully,
of what's going on, whether it's a successful mission
to
wherever, you know.
You see, we sit here now, and at this current moment in space on the planet Mars, the Perseverance rover is wandering round, I'll say wandering, going a precise path as tracked by the scientists, collecting rock samples. It is collecting rock samples, which is storing inside the body of the spacecraft, and it is taking them ultimately to a site in Mars where another rocket will come and land and bring those samples back to Earth and give us the chance to examine rocks from Mars before we go there. That is part of the Perseverance plan that was budgeted for 10 years ago when the programme was first started. They've just effectively pulled the plug on the Mars sample return mission. The Mars sample return mission is the ability to send another spacecraft to Mars to bring back these samples. They haven't pulled it totally. What they've said is the budget has spiralled out of control. It was like $10 billion, I think. And they've said, we can't afford to do that. So they were looking at another means of doing it. And there's a whole host of different ideas coming up. But they've recently said they will make a review of it early next year as to whether they go ahead, whether they do a much reduced budget, or whether they cancel it completely. And I'm afraid, I hope it doesn't get cancelled, because it seems pointless having the half the job done and not doing the other half. But there is a fly in the ointment, the right word? The Chinese, in the meantime, have said, oh, we're going to go and get samples from Mars, and we were going to launch in 2030 to go to Mars and bring them back by 2034. They've just pulled their budget and their funding forward for the mission to 2028. So think of all the political things that are going on at the moment, and think of the individuals involved. And China have said, we're going to do it in 2028. And America's saying, well, we're not going to do it in 2030. We're going to do it in 2032, or every 2 years, an opening window for Mars, you see. And I think that's going to rattle a few bars, and all of a sudden I think the Americans will find the money. But that's politics, not science.
And the two really, you can't use one to play off the other,
It's a space race all over again. It's the Russians and the Americans. It's the Chinese and the Americans now. So, but who knows?
It's tricky.
It is very tricky. Another one that's been pulled is there was a mission, you may recall, it wasn't that much in the news, but we actually sent a spacecraft called OSIRIS. OSIRIS went all the way to an asteroid called Bennu and brought back samples of rock of Bennu, and it showed that this material predates the origin of the solar system. It's really primordial stuff. And this spacecraft is still working. The spacecraft, they've got scientists working on this new flight plan and all the rest, and they've called the new mission OSIRIS Apex, as opposed to the original was OSIRIS-REx. They've cancelled it. Full, lock, stock and barrel, pulled the mission completely. They're not carrying on at all. They've completely cancelled it. And I feel sorry for the students or the scientists or the engineers who are building these things and designing these things. They've got all the mission plans. And then just out the blue, they've pulled the lot.
Well, there are so many questions on either side, aren't there, really? Because we've talked about the value of space exploration in what it teaches us in engineering and
social skills, everything else, every aspect.
What we learn. So it is, yes, it is a massive investment, but it can give us the research and the results that moves a lot of different disciplines.
Yeah.
However, when you've got a finite budget that's got to be divided up, you know, and you're talking about billions for that. Yeah. You can see how the...
I think what's going to happen, I think as a consequence of all this, I think what may have happened, there was a bit of a lull in NASA's budget in the early 2000s. And then slowly but surely that's been increased again to build the Artemis mission and the Mars missions and all the rest. Maybe they've increased it too much and now they've had to take a look back and say, well, hang on, we still want to go into space. We still want to do these missions, but maybe we need to slow down our acceleration of doing them. They're not as much for national pride as more for scientific reasons. And that, I hope, might be the case, that maybe the funding will be pulled, but it won't be pulled totally. They'll still have the ability to tick them over a little bit and maybe the development slower over a period of years. But the going back to the moon, all this stuff about going back to the moon, they're still going to go back to the moon with the Artemis 3 mission. Artemis 2 is launching next year. Artemis 3 is going the year after. They've pulled everything after that. Now, they boasted, the big thing was, we're going back to the moon to stay. We're going to build a lunar base. We're going to use it as a stepping stone for going to Mars. We're going to use it to mine helium-3, which will help us with our energy needs. But they're just going to pull it. They're going to go back to the moon for one mission and that's it, pull it. And that just seems... Why go in the first place? And that's the next thing. They might scrap the whole thing, which I hope they don't. But I was very, very hopeful. In my lifetime, I really thought there was a very real chance we were going to get people on Mars, people walking on the surface of Mars by the mid-2030s. I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's so much dissatisfaction. There's so much distrust of that, the whole system. Pasadena, the JPL laboratory in Pasadena, a lot of people who, after COVID, work from home because the scientists with the computers and all the rest, they issued a directive. If you don't, after the next 3 months, if you don't come back to work, you've deemed to sack yourself. Now, whether you like working from home as a concept or what, it doesn't matter, but that's how serious it's got. And there are people losing their jobs left, right and centre. It's very worrying. And as you say, there's an awful lot of negativity around. And I haven't got anything positive to say at the moment in the space exploration world.
Well,
other than the Chinese. The Chinese are really pushing ahead. And the Indians are pushing ahead. They're going to have an unmanned mission soon. And they're pushing ahead. The European Space Agency, for all the problems they've got, the European Space Agency are still pushing ahead. But the United States, who are, let's be honest, the biggest player in the whole game, they are really reeling from budget implications and decisions like that.
But you feel there are so many different things that could be considered here. I mean, we have said ages ago when we were talking about the cost of all this, that surely there's a case for everybody working together on the same projects.
Yeah.
Because there must surely be an awful lot of overlap in research
and
development.
Europe and the United States, well, the European Space Agency, which includes Canada, incidentally, which is a bit of an anomaly, but the European Space Agency and NASA are working very closely together. But there's another mission, the ExoMars mission, which was pulled because of the Ukraine situation, which is warfare has an issue. And they were meant to be partnering with the United States on that. But now the funding for that's drying up a second time. And now they're struggling to get that going. And that was meant to be on Mars in 2022, the same as Perseverance. It's sitting in a laboratory in Stevenage, I believe, this rover, the Nancy, forgot my name of the rover now, but the rover was built and designed and meant to be going, and it's just sitting there, can't be launched.
Nancy Roman.
No, Nancy Roman's the telescope, which we're going to talk about in just a moment. This is the woman who discovered DNA.
Oh.
Oh, I've forgotten her name. Rosalind Franklin. Rosalind Franklin rover. That's it. It's a Rosalind Franklin rover, which was meant to launch on a Russian rocket in 2020 to get to Mars in 21. And that's nowhere near getting launched now, I'm afraid. But the Nancy Roman telescope, which just to mention briefly, the Nancy Roman telescope was planned to be launched later this year. And it's all ready to go and everything else. Now, you think there's a lot of money invested in one of these satellites, these telescopes, whatever, and this is going to look for dark matter and dark energy and answer some of our questions we were mentioning in the first part of the program. But they're really looking at that. They've slashed the budget for it, and NASA are saying that if you slash the budget for it, then what's the point of launching it? Because we can't analyze the data. You know, be careful what you wish for. They might get the whole thing pulled on them, which, again, that's the it's not the successor, but it's going to work in partnership with Hubble and indeed with the James Webb.
Do you think this could possibly be saved if somebody came up with a different budgetary plan that didn't look quite so, didn't have quite such a heavy bottom line on it?
Well, private industry might be the answer. And you've got SpaceX, I know
he's was just, but surely this is even outside the budget of the current.
He seems to be spending money hand over fist. There's Elon Musk. I know he's fallen out with Trump, but they seem to have made up again, I think. But he's pushing ahead with all his plans. Incidentally, the one space story, which it was a bit of a disaster, which we haven't spoken about, I know we're going to run out of time, is the fact that SpaceX were getting their rocket ready to test launch their 10th edition of the Starship, and it blew up on the pad where they did a static fire test. And that's caused no end of problems because they're meant to be using that rocket to get back to the moon. Actually, just realised what I'm saying. The Artemis 4 mission was going to use a SpaceX rocket, which they're not now going to use it. So, but I think the answer is private industry. I think the likes of Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, who's in the news at the moment with his wedding, those are the guys, like private aviation kicked off in the 1920s, I think you're going to see the same with space. But it's going to be far more selective and far more revenue. I mean, space hotels, orbiting space hotels or flights, suborbital spacecraft around the world, things that have got a revenue stream rather than just an exploration. And that's, I think, the subtle change we're going to see over the next few years.
Not just subtle. I think that's going to be quite a major change if that is how it's going to go. And that could, in fact, keep the programmes going.
Keep them going, but
in a different way.
Not for the science, but for the making money.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I'm watching this TV series at the moment called For All Mankind. People may have watched it. And it's all about the Russians get the moon first and there's an orbiting space hotel and all this stuff. And there's a chap in that who's just like Elon Musk. So who knows what the future is going to bring. But we'll tell you all about it on Mike's Radio
All I can say is that certainly we'll have plenty of opportunity to discuss it in the months ahead.
We certainly will.
Howard, I'm sorry that we couldn't inject a little bit more positivity into all of this.
I'm sorry too.
But thank you very much indeed for joining us. You have been listening to this month's edition of The Manx Sky at Night with Howard Parker. And he will be back on the final Sunday of the month of July. Fast am I, Howard.
Fast am I, Judith.
The Nation Station makes